these. Maybe I should wear these.
Fine, I'm fine. Volume.
Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show. This is Julie Calamine, your morning show host, and I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Huff. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Julie.
How are you doing?
Doing great.
Oh, good. Good to hear it.
Breaking the weather, almost. The skies were trying to be blue on the way in.
They sure were, and I think we're going to have a little more of that. We've got a really interesting show this morning. We're going to be joined by Rich Del Carlo. He's a local birder, a local arborist. He's one of our most knowledgeable people about birds in the area, and I'll be introducing him in a moment. But let's cover the rest of the weather and then back to Rich. Today, we're expecting a high of 37 and some fair skies, so that's going to be pretty nice. Looks like we've got a bit more of that coming. Tomorrow, Wednesday, we're looking at a high around 50, slight chance of showers, only 20%. Low Wednesday night of 35, and then a little more of the same on Thursday, a high of 45, 60% chance of
rain.
Rain, that's right.
I think spring's on the way somewhere in the mix there, although winter's not releasing its grip on us so easily, although the skiers are loving it. Record-setting snow up at Schweitzer?
That's right, and the last day is coming this Saturday, so everybody needs to be aware of that. So, Phil, have you been doing anything outdoors? Have you been noticing spring weather?
Oh, I've been kicking some mud around and trying to pull out a little bit of yard debris, waiting for the last of the snowdrifts to melt before we get the wheelbarrow in action.
Same for me. I've been clearing up my lawn, clearing up the yard, and trying to get things cleaned up, and a little fishing too, of course.
What I've noticed is a few of the large branches we might have hired an arborist to take down. Winter did it on its own.
And what does that do? That brings us to our morning show guest this morning, and that is Rich Del Carlo. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning.
How are you?
Great.
And busy, I suppose. It must be a busy spring for an arborist.
It is. And then, you know, there's a lot of cleanup and then just kind of been working around the weather as well. So it's been a slow start, but busy when we're there.
I've always been a little bit curious. is there a season to your work? Are there things you typically find yourself doing in the spring that you may not later on in the year?
Yeah. Right now, doing a lot of fruit trees. some winter cleanup, but primarily focusing on fruit trees. And, you know, it is a kind of a later season, so there's not as big a sense of urgency to get it done in the next, you know, couple of weeks before it flowers. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, I have I was looking at a picture that I took April 7th, 2 years ago, with my apricot tree in full flower covered with bees. And I took a picture the same day of those giant snowflakes coming down. So a little different year this year.
That's for sure. Rich, you're talking about pruning trees, and I know our topic is not pruning, but I always think it's getting too late for pruning fruit trees when it starts to warm up, but not so maybe.
Well, you know, there's no real time that you cannot prune. It's like, you know, I mean, you don't want to prune when trees are flowering because the trees are kind of delicate at that point. Just with the flowers, but it's so much easier to prune when the leaves are not on there, so you can see the structure, and it just helps to move through them a little faster.
Sure. Now, of course, I've digressed. Rich is here this morning for two reasons, and one is that he knows everything there is to know, or almost everything there is to know about birds in our area, and of course, he also knows about landscaping for birds and the right plants and shrubs for habitat, for food for birds. But let's start with birds themselves. Rich, can you tell us how it is that you came to be interested in both, well, first birding and then in your work as an arborist?
Well, I think that my parents kind of instilled that awareness into me. They weren't avid birders, but they fed birds and enjoyed seeing them in their yards or whenever we went on vacation. That was kind of a, you know, thing that they noticed. So that was an early thing that they inspired in me, and then I got an interest in it. And I was thinking about that I think the bird that really kind of got me into actual birding was when the first time I saw a black-throated gray warbler in the Sierras. And I went with a group of friends who were who were actual birders, and you know, we saw these birds for the first time, and that was kind of like the inspiration to really pursue it. And I've, you know, I kind of have more of a science background, so I did some was involved with some studies and population studies and things like that. So that's kind of how I really became way more interested in it.
And you've had a lifelong interest in birds, we understand that, but more recently, and it has been a while, you became involved with Audubon here in the Sandpoint area. And I know that because I've joined you on the Christmas bird count.
Well, Audubon was just something that I've always supported and, you know, read the magazine. And initially, you know, the Christmas bird count, which was, I joined with when Earl Chapin was kind of the head of that. And then I took over for Earl after he realized that he didn't want to put the list on the web and deal with the computer.
So are the Christmas bird count, are that the population studies you've been talking about, or it sounds like there might have been something in addition to that?
That was in addition. That was in Oregon and California and other places. I actually worked, volunteered for several months at the Point Reyes Bird Observatory in California.
And I suspect there, by the nature of the topography, you see a lot of migrant birds passing through.
Yes. There's migrant birds everywhere.
Maybe migrant waterfowl. Yeah. Would that be the key word? So you took over from Earl Chapin, and of course that's a name known to birders in the area, and he was around for a long time and very helpful, and now you've taken over that work. But you would both know or would know about the seasons, the comings and goings of birds, and we are now in the spring season, and it's a different time of year, isn't it? We're enjoying lots of bird activity again.
We're starting to see bird activity. You know, they, yeah, I mean, the spring is when everything starts happening. You know, I'd like to go back, if I could, to one of your questions about, you know, relating birds and trees.
Thank you for sending me back, because sometimes I rush ahead.
Well, I felt we were going to maybe not get back there.
So no, we got to get back there.
You know, just through the knowledge of local flora and fauna, you gain an awareness of what's around, and it's not only the birds and the trees, but insects and reptiles and everything. And so there's, you know, there's just that connection that once you are aware of one thing, you realize that everything is connected.
It's all connected to everything else, as has been noted by many folks before. How did you become interested in the topics of trees and becoming an arborist?
It was merely by chance to some degree. I was looking for a job in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I just went into a tree service, applied for a job, and it happened to have been a tree service that was kind of cutting edge in the term in arbor care, and I from the very first day I learned the right way you know, about trees and pruning, and also that work ethic that comes along with that. So I was pretty lucky.
And you're outdoors, and you're with the plants and the animals and the birds.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, which was already an interest for you.
Yes.
Right. And that grew into business here in town. And so you've spent, from that beginning, have you remained in the industry of working with trees? Has it been
linear? You know, I mean, from California to here, there were some gaps in different jobs, but that always stayed with me. And then I was able to incorporate my knowledge into the business I have.
So it's always interesting. This is a good spot, I think, to find out what brought people to the area. How is it you found North Idaho and moved here?
That's interesting. I moved up here in 85, actually, with my first wife, and she was was working on a forestry degree. And so she got a job at the Barnes Ferry Ranger District. And then I actually got a job at the Kootenai National Wildlife Refuge as the biologist there for seasonal work in the summer. So that was a really great experience.
Yeah, and a great place for birds. Another great place for birds.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, in my desire and need to be outside, I didn't get a degree in wildlife or ornithology, so I had created a ceiling for myself, and so I had to find other things to do.
Yeah.
But luckily it's worked out because you've had great association.
It's been great.
Yeah. Well, we now understand better how the two go together for you. You're in the outdoors, you enjoy plants and animals and birds, and you get to work outdoors with trees, and you've got great knowledge. And that translates into maybe understanding birds a bit better than the rest of us. You're up with them.
Absolutely. You know, and just no matter what you do, if there's an awareness, you know, a heightened awareness, you know, I key in on bird sounds. I have learned bird behavior and just subtleties and to know what is kind of going on. And I can kind of anticipate what, you know, like, you know, we do a lot of work in the summer, and that's kind of the nesting season. And so, you know, I always see these subtle behaviors that I know there's probably a bird nesting in this tree, in this bush. And so with that knowledge, I'm able to make a decision. Well, maybe we can wait a few weeks and, I'll present that to people, and usually they're like, yeah, that's cool. Let's wait till those flickers have done nesting, or the western flycatcher is off that branch. And so
there's times, I'm sure, when landscaping concerns conflict with the wildlife concerns, but there's opportunities on a landscape in North Idaho with people of sufficient size property to accommodate a more natural state, leave some snags or...
Absolutely, yes.
That's right. Let's talk about what's happening in the bird world. I was mentioning to both you and Phil as we were talking before we began today that as I looked out the window from our building here in downtown, I was noticing the swallows. So there are a bunch of birds showing up.
There are a bunch of birds showing up.
Let's talk about them. What are they?
Well, you know, people probably noticed... earlier in, you know, March, that there were a lot of swans around, and you maybe even heard swans flying over. Once they start moving, there's flocks of them coming off the lake, and they're flying north to the tundra, and so they're just about gone now.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of ducks and waterfowl have been moving through. There's been hundreds of American widgeon, ringneck ducks, mallards, lots of mallards, and pintail. Yesterday I saw a flock of 50 or so snow geese, which is actually unusual for this area.
Hmm.
Over in Freeze Out Lake, Montana, it's a really amazing spot in March and April to see 50, 60,000 snow geese and swans. But we don't have those numbers here. So that 50 snow geese was unusual and kind of interesting.
And fortunately, the swans and the snow geese are birds that are not the hardest to identify.
That's true.
Those ones are pretty easy even for me.
Yeah.
Now, one that you hear before you see, and I always mark spring, is the varied thrush.
Hmm.
But I haven't heard the varied thrush yet, at least.
I've heard a couple.
Okay, good.
But they should be.
Spring is coming, Julie.
Spring is coming. Good. Another thing that's happening with the birds, you mentioned the swallows, and they're kind of dependent on the warmer weather. They, you know, they're insect eaters. They eat flying insects. So when it warms up, the insects are kind of flying around. So there haven't been a whole lot around yet, but they're starting to show up. bluebirds are coming back, red-winged blackbirds, and then that's kind of what's around now. And then starting in May, that's when the big flow of birds, the neotropical migrants, the warblers, the vireos, sparrows, the, start coming back.
It's about now. We usually see the return of the osprey. Have you seen any yet?
I have not seen any, but any day, I would think, that they should be around.
It seems like they should be here, but I have not seen one either.
Well, it's cold. They're happy down in Mexico.
That's right. Well,
you know, you mentioned Mexico. I was in Mexico, the coast of Mexico, for 2 weeks down south of Puerto Vallarta, and saw a lot of birds. But what was interesting was the saw a lot of the birds that actually are in my yard in the summer that winter in Mexico and even further south. And, you know, when you start kind of thinking about that, you know, a little warbler, a vireo, a hummingbird can fly, navigate that trip is really...
It's really amazing.
It's incredible, yeah.
Something I've wondered about osprey, because they're obligate fish eaters. And around here, of course, we think of them as freshwater. They go down to the coast of the Gulf. Do they also feed in the salt? Do they do a little surf and turf, or do they stick to the ponds and the shallows?
They do a little surf and turf.
Phil, I can give you a definitive answer on that, because I received that answer from our wildlife biologist, the osprey specialist that was here. Yeah. And the answer is yes, they will eat saltwater fish.
Good. Nice to see they have a varied diet.
They're just
opportunistic. All birds are.
Well, Rich, that's so interesting. You were in Mexico and you were seeing your friends from the Idaho Panhandle. You mentioned a couple. Are there other species that you recognize that would normally be in your yard in the summer when you're in Mexico?
Well, Nashville warblers, McGillivray's warbler, yellow-rump warbler, American redstart, Cassin's vireo.
That's a lot.
We also see about the time our cherry trees begin to move from flower to fruit, we'll see the western tanagers come through. So that's a ways off yet,
but they will be here probably the second week of May.
Yep.
By the end of May, all of the birds are pretty much back. First of June, everything is here. They're basically singing and setting up territories. But right now, they're just kind of trickling in. So we're seeing the swallows and the bluebirds right now, and then it's all related to food. Mm-hmm. Okay. So once the insects are out and the trees are flowering and the bugs are on the trees, then we'll start seeing those insectivores.
Mm-hmm. Rich, what do our residents think about the influx of the migrants? How do they adjust to that? They've been by themselves all winter, and here everyone just shows up again. I wonder what that's like.
I think they're okay with immigrants.
So we have a texted question from a caller who recently saw a blue jay at the feeder.
Oh, yeah.
A Steller's jay?
Probably Eastern blue jay.
Yeah.
Really?
Which is not common, but we have seen a couple over time.
So, yes, exactly. They do show up. Jays are fairly adaptable and, you know, can kind of establish in different areas. I don't think that they actually have an established population here, but they see them in the spring and the fall.
And they seem to mix okay. At least another friend last week reported getting a Steller's jay and a blue jay at their feeder at the same time.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Interesting. That's interesting. I have a question about hummingbirds. I'm wanting to know when should I be thinking about getting my feeder out soon, or do I have some time?
You have some time, especially this year. There's virtually nothing flowering, and typically they're here last week of April, first week of May.
A little bit of time, but we need to be thinking about it. We don't want them sitting and being hungry when they're here.
No. Yeah. And a reminder, you don't need to put dye in hummingbird food.
No.
No.
It's, you know, I mean, it's just something that people did and still do, and it's not necessary and, right. you know, obviously can be a detriment. So,
right.
But cleaning hummingbird feeders is super important.
I've noticed they'll stop eating if I don't keep my feeder clean. They just stop coming to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that, you know, it's just like if you had left, you know, a glass of milk sitting on the counter for a day, it wouldn't be too appealing. So it's, you know, it's, yeah. so yeah, that fresh food is important. They know when things are distasteful and bad. And
it's also important to clean not only for the food, but so that they don't spread diseases.
Absolutely. And pests. Yeah. Right.
What other birds do we need to keep an eye out for? And what other birds might we be thinking of helping in their journey north?
Well, I think that the main thing that we can do to help any birds out is be aware of what a huge impact windows can have.
This is not the first time you've mentioned
it.
No,
and I'm going to keep mentioning it too, because it is. It's an unbelievably huge thing, and we are, you know, obviously a society that enjoys those vast views, and those big windows are just you don't realize what a an impact it has, and that's part of my you know, the curse to my awareness of things is, you know, I see the birds, and we live in a fairly small house, and I've covered as many windows as I can with a screen that becomes actually invisible once you're used to it. And I still get birds hitting small windows. And so you can imagine those giant pane glass windows that face out to the lake are a real problem. So that's, I would say that is kind of the main thing that actually...
So what are some of the other things? People can put up a screen so it's less reflective, and also fine mesh netting outside?
Yes. Yeah, and that's a big thing, you know. And even like houses that are left vacant for a good part of the year, if people were able to put, you know, something across the windows, that would definitely help. Decals do not seem to have any impact. You know, if you put a decal of a hawk on there, it really doesn't help. But there are some things that can break up that glare, because that's what's happening, is they just, you know, they're seeing the basically trees and the sky in your window, and they're just continuing on.
Thinks it's still part of their territory.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's architecturally, there's things that can be done too. There is glass that is, obviously it would cost more, but it is there's the potential to put glass that is less reflective in that way, but you can still see out. And
You know, so many of us have our windows because we want the view, so this seems like a difficult, a thorny issue, because I would think there would be resistance from certain homeowners to wanting to make too many changes to their windows and not be able to see through them as well.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, just think about how tragic it is.
It is.
You know, there's a flycatcher that just came back from Costa Rica, made that trip, and the first thing, but you know, it ends up flying into your window. I mean, it's heartbreaking.
I don't want to.
And when people are aware of that, I mean, they don't, you know.
Right. Awareness is the first step.
Exactly.
And I must interrupt and say this. If you've heard that sad and disheartening thump on your window, it does make a difference. It's a terribly sad sound. I would agree. I'm going to mention one more thing about windows, and then we'll move on. And this is a little experiment I've been doing, so we don't know that this is working 100%, but I've tried a piece of masking tape in a couple of spots on my window that isn't all the way affixed. It's loose, and it sort of moves. It does seem to make a difference. I don't know if they see the moving tape and they veer off at the last moment, but seems to make a difference. Mm. Looks kind of strange, but one can still see through the window. Anyway, that's my input.
Tassels. You know, the nice thing about that netting is that it's away from the window, and it basically you know, birds can cushions. Fly into it, and then they just basically bounce off. Right.
There you go. There you go.
That seems like the best approach.
Yeah, but not always, not for everyone.
It's, you know, I mean, it's not, nothing's easy, right? It's,
right. But to be recommended. Yeah. All right, well, that's an important one. And then there would be food. We could do food. We could help with food and habitat.
Habitat is big. You know, anything you can do with for shelter and nesting and protection is good. And, so, you know, I feed birds all year, sunflower seeds and suet. And, you know, there you also need sanitation is important there. It's really important, actually, because there's a disease that finches get from the bacteria that, you know, if you have wet, gross seed in there, it doesn't take much to make that happen. But
we should also note that one of the more damaging things to songbird populations are domesticated house cats let loose outside near the bird feeders.
And that's coming from a cat lover.
Yeah, our guys stay inside. We don't want them to be part of the food chain up or down.
Yeah. No. Well, Julie knew I was going to mention that, and I was avoiding it. But yeah, you're right.
Cats are big.
Let's put it right out of the table. Keep the cats indoors.
They're predators. I mean, they're really, really good predators. Cats are... So they survive.
So on that somber note, we should remind people we're listening to 88.5 KRFY FM in Ponderay, listener-supported radio for North Idaho. And this morning's morning show host, Julie and myself, are interviewing our guest today, Rich Del Carlo, a certified arborist, Sandpoint Audubon Christmas Bird Count Coordinator, longtime birder.
And we're going to come back to some topics related to landscaping for birds. We're going to move on to that, but let's take her with two birds. What a nice song. We have agreement from all three folks in the studio that was a nice one.
She sounds like a bird.
It sort of does, doesn't she? What a sweet bird-like voice. For those of you just joining us, this is 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. If you have only heard part of our broadcast this morning, you can go ahead and listen later via our podcast, and you'll find that at krfy.org. We're returning to our morning show, Tuesday morning show. This is Julie Callum, and I'm here with Phil Huff, and we are interviewing Rich Del Carlo, and his first hat is that he's an arborist. His second hat is that he's a very experienced birder. I think we're going to go to his arborist hat for the moment and talk about landscaping for birds and habitat, food, etc. So let's move on to how we can make our homes as hospitable to birds as they are to us. Rich.
Okay. Well, you know, if we provide for birds, we're actually providing for ourselves. You know, there's the benefit emotionally that we have, that, you know, when we're connected to nature, there's no question that that does not help us out emotionally and helps us to relax. And then also, you know, bird-friendly landscapes are ultimately homes to beneficial insects and pollinators, butterflies and bees and snakes and... you know, just kind of, you kind of get a complete system. Even when it's in your yard, you can have, you know, a working ecosystem, basically.
Right. They're a very important part of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, birds are pollinators. They eat insects. They, you know, and then the other benefit would be that when you have that deliberate awareness and you know, of birds and habitat, you're going to use less pesticides. It's going to be healthier for you. It's better for the soil. You know, there's just so many benefits because, like we said before, you know, everything is connected.
It's true.
And we're part of that connection also.
So are there certain kinds of landscaping suggestions you'd have either on the large scale, this general type of landscaping, or even more fine-tuned down to specific trees or shrubs?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we live in a place with a tremendous diversity of plants that, so there's, you know, out of town, there's just the native vegetation that's there. Mm-hmm. There we have the benefit of large trees, which are huge. You know, you need to leave dead trees, not only for birds, but insects, bats, things like that.
Do you have some favorite large trees that if say a person's saying, I need some large trees, Rich, what would be good for birds? I know there are many birds and many trees, but are there a couple of favorites that are go-tos for you?
Well, you know, the large trees in town are provide a huge amount of habitat for birds. There's a whole world, aerial world, that's going on above us that we aren't even aware of. You know, one of the most visible raptors in the spring and summer in Sandpoint is Merlin, mm-hmm. a little falcon that, you know, I mean, they eat birds. They eat swallows and pigeons and sparrows and robins. But it's, you know, then they nest in old crow nests. And right now, you know, they're on territory. You can hear them calling. And, you know, that's just a really cool thing to have. And they rely on larger trees just because they nest in the tops. But it would be well hidden in the canopy.
But it seems like not a far leap to assume that if we want healthy native populations of birds, landscaping with native plants and trees, you know, has a certain benefit.
It does have a certain benefit, but there's also non-native plants mm-hmm. that have the same benefits in terms of fruiting and flowers and cover. So, you know, obviously the native plants are ones that birds have evolved with and are more used to eating and relying on, but there's no absolute. Obviously, if you live in a place where you have native vegetation, keeping that is a benefit. And the benefit, well, you know, the benefit to you is it's less maintenance. Mm-hmm. You know, we kind of have gotten into this mindset that everything has to be completely manicured and rake up every stick and leaf. You know, we are moving away from, or trying to move away from big lawns and that heavily intensified management. You know, it's a very high maintenance situation, a lawn.
High energy input. We put a lot in for what we get out.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, people are taking lawns out to put in gardens. And so, you know, I think that a diversity of plants, you know, like even in a vegetable garden, if you have trees and shrubs around there, you can still have habitat for birds. They'll come into your garden and forage and scratch. Mm-hmm. And
so sometimes we want them in the gardens to eat those larvae, but there are some things we plant, like strawberries, we don't want them pecking around it. What's that true. Best combination of keeping them away from the strawberries but making sure they can pick off the insects?
Well,
that's,
you know,
screens.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you have to definitely put covers over the strawberries because they'll get eaten.
Or just enjoy the fact that the birds enjoy the strawberries.
Well, there is that.
Give them an offering.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, Rich, because you've been around birds and you've been an arborist for a long time, and I don't hear you saying that only native plants are the solution for happy bird situations. And it's interesting because a caller, had asked me to mention this to you about persistent fruit, and it's often seen on plants that aren't native, like a crabapple or, you know, some other form. Another place where we see a lot of it is on a high bush cranberry, which I think probably is a native. But I was mentioning that for fruits that are supposed to be so attractive to birds, we often see a lot of it still around. Wondering why is that?
I think because of the timing of when that fruits maybe, and then a lot of times it's those flocks of birds that come in that eat the fruit, like on a mountain ash, which, you know, there's native mountain ash in the mountains, but we don't actually have native mountain ash here, and so those are all ornamentals. But when a flock of birds comes in and they discover it, then they're pretty much gone.
Which is sort of like in the garden, you know, sometimes you're spared and sometimes they come through. Right.
Well, a few things need to survive for the plant to eventually reproduce.
Well, that's true. Yeah. So, you know, there's always remnant fruit. I think that planting anything that flowers and fruits, you know, one of the greatest native plants we have, and it's early, is serviceberry. It's one of the first things that flowers in the spring, and then has a berry, and the birds love that. It's a nice, you know, it's a nice plant. Elderberry is another one. Excellent wildlife tree. Hawthorn.
Pretty spiky.
The natives are really spiky. But there are, you know, non-native ones that have berries and flower, and anything that flowers has a benefit to, bees and pollinators and birds.
And as we work our way down in the height category, we're thinking of other things like lower shrubs, maybe blueberries or roses, and even lower ground covers, right?
Yeah, I just had a thought, if you don't mind. I was thinking about birch trees, and I've seen osprey. We were talking about osprey, and I've seen osprey in town flying across the tops of birch and actually grabbing dead branches, breaking off dead branches to take to their nest. So, you know, if you're in a position where you have a big birch tree and it's got a little dead in it, you know, you don't necessarily have to take all of those dead branches out of there. Birch is a kind of a tree that will, you're not going to get a gigantic major failure from a birch. It kind of falls apart in pieces on the dead, and the living branches are pretty strong. So, you know, if I try and, you know, tell people that if it's in a situation where you don't have to take, and that's something that as an arborist that we're learning also, you don't have to take every piece of deadwood out of a tree.
And if you have a birch, and I've had this happen, that snaps off 15 feet up.
Right.
That remaining 15-foot stump doesn't pose a threat to most anything, usually.
Exactly.
And you can leave it as a fairly attractive landscaping feature that has a lot of great benefit for birds and other small animals.
There's so many species of birds that nest in birch. Mm-hmm. So, it's, you know, so anyway, sorry to diverge on that.
No problem.
I want to make sure there's time to ask you about the water ouzel. I'm in the midst of reading the collected works of John Muir, and he writes very eloquently for a whole chapter about the sweet songs of the water ouzel and having become acquainted with specific birds and followed them for a year or more, listening to their songs every day. And he writes just lovingly about it. And we were talking a little bit before the show about this. I'd love your reflections on the water ouzel, better known to some as the dipper.
Dipper, yeah. Well, that's a bird that does not migrate. And spend their whole year on these little streams, Grouse Creek, Rapid Lightning, all of the stream. They're not they wouldn't necessarily be along on the lake, but streams coming into the lake and little streams along anywhere here. They spend their whole year there. Even when it's frozen, they find a little. They'll be on the ice, one of their characteristics is, the reason they're called a dipper is they kind of bob, and then they dive in and they're eating aquatic insects, nymphs, all year. And so, and they have a beautiful song. It's unbelievable. It's just, sometimes they'll nest under bridges, but typically on rocky, kind of rocky, under in rocky areas. Under waterfall kind of thing.
Yeah, with lots of moss.
Lots of moss, yes. Yeah, they're really cool birds.
They are. They're such interesting little creatures. And for people like me and my friends who fish quite a bit, we've seen them. And it's just always a special surprise to see one dipping along.
Yeah.
Really beautiful.
They can stay under the water for quite a while.
They can.
I think we all have our own favorites, but that might be a new favorite of mine.
Mm.
Well, while we're talking about favorites, what about favorite birds? Rich, what are some of the favorites you've come to know over the years? You have probably seen more than we have.
You know, the name of my business is Peregrine Tree and Landscape. So I have kind of peregrines have always been a really interesting part of my life. And so that's one of my favorite birds. But, you know, I mean, any bird, when you start looking at its uniqueness, is amazing. So it's hard to pick a
Can be a favorite. Do you see peregrine falcons here in the panhandle?
Not very often.
It's a rare sighting.
It is. But they are, you know, they're a bird that's doing so much better. They were almost extinct, you know, during the DDT egg thinning years, and they've recovered through through human efforts. Actually,
they like those high cliffy perches and dives.
They like those high cliffy perches, but they also like skyscrapers.
Yes, I was going to say that. Last time I saw one was in an office I was working in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And there was a couple nesting nearby up about the 30th floor.
It's pretty amazing that they, you know, they can make a living in the city, eating pigeons at Central Park.
Yeah.
That was one of the reasons that I that became one of my birds was one of the things that I did as part of in my studies was studying shorebird migration on the Washington coast. And if you've never seen a big mass of shorebirds, it's something that you have to see because they're just amazing the way that they interact together. It looks when they're flying and it looks like a ribbon blowing in the wind and they're just moving as one. And so, but falcons hunt those work those shorebird flocks. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the things that I was privileged to see when I was doing that study. And it was really amazing.
Pretty neat. No reason to be inspired by birds. Well, Rich, you've told us a little bit about what not to do with birds. We don't want to kill them off as soon as we get here. We want to try and feed them and provide them landscaping opportunities for nesting and places to be safe. Is there anything else we should be thinking about this spring as we go into summer to try and keep our birds safe and try and see a lot of them in the area?
I think that I just always encourage people to be more aware, to start listening and seeing, and because it's such a, it brings your life to a different level, really, because there's just so much, there's so much out there, and birds are such a visible part of that. Talking about awareness, I remember an example. I was in town talking to somebody, and I heard this robin making this racket. So, you know, being aware of bird sounds and the differences in those sounds alerts you to different things. And so I heard this alarm call that this robin was making, and I looked to the sound, and there's this robin being chased at just about eye level by a merlin. And the person I was talking to did not even hear that. And I was just amazed that, like, wow, how could you not have heard that? But it's something that, you know, becomes, once you're aware of that, then you just kind of key into those sounds.
There's an element of human psychology. Once we are aware of something, we see it repeatedly. And before we are, we just never do.
Yeah.
So
it's true. And bird songs at first all sound so similar, but they really are quite different. Really
are. They are.
Yes.
And I have to, I admit that I have to relearn all the warbler sounds when they come back. Right now it's fairly easy because the juncos are singing, and then you start adding to that. But then once first week of June, then everything is singing together.
A lot of warbler songs, yeah. Aren't there?
Yes.
Are there any, we're running a little short on time, are there any upcoming events we should be aware of, or specific happenings or things to look for? And up in Creston,
I think that I think they actually have a bird festival first week or second week of May.
Yeah, usually early May.
Yeah. But, you know, right now, the lake is still really good. Just taking a walk in a wetland or Dover, Mikinik Trail.
Yeah. Just getting out and listening to the new sounds and seeing what's flying around us.
Yeah. And you don't have to know what it is necessarily, but just being aware that, of the differences and where they're at, and I think is really a benefit to.
It adds. We feel spring when we hear all the birds.
That is true.
Thank you for coming on the show this morning, Rich. We appreciate it.
That's always great. Thank you very much.
That's right. And good luck with all the upcoming trimming. I'm sure there's plenty ahead.
I got to head out there right now.
That's right. Well, thank you, Rich Del Carlo, for telling us about the birds of spring and some things we can think about as we move into spring and work on our landscapes and how we might help the birds. So that's been great advice this morning. We'll take Amy Lou Harris with Little Bird. For those of you just joining us, this is KRFY 88.5, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. This is Julie Calamine. I'm here with Phil Huff. We've just had Rich Del Carlo telling us about birds.
One of our springtime traditions.
He is, and so worth it, because even if we've heard some of this information before, and we have, it's always great to have a reminder about how to take care of our little winged friends. Phil, we're going to talk about what's happening with morning shows and then on to upcoming events.
Who's coming up this week?
All right. So tomorrow, please join Susie Prez and Chris Bessler for Local Decision Primary 2018. Invited guests are Republican candidates for the District 1 seat. That's tomorrow at 8. And then on Thursday, I hope that you will consider joining Jack Peterson and Jim Healy, and their guest will be Eric Ridgway, who will talk about an upcoming film sponsored by the Sandpoint Men's Group, and that's tomorrow at 8. Then next week, please join Phil and me next Tuesday, and we'll be talking with Spencer Neatman. He is a local farmer with Moose Meadow Gardeners, and we may have an additional guest too, but that's still to be determined. Upcoming events, Phil.
Oh, well, it's busy. We have time for a few. Tomorrow on the 11th at Idaho Port Authority, Washington Elementary PTA will hold a fundraiser from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Most people probably know the drill. Go down there and drink for the cause. On Thursday, the 12th, the North Idaho Federated Republican Women Candidates Forum will be held beginning at 5:30 p.m. at the Holiday Inn Express in Pondere. So always get out and learn more about the candidates and issues. On the 13th, 14th, as well as the 19th and 21st, Shrek the Musical will be presented by Growing Dreams Productions, Inc. and Sandpoint High School Mime and Mask. Now, that sounds like a lot of fun.
It does sound fun.
The Sandpoint High School Auditorium shows are at 7 p.m. each night with an extra matinee performance on the 14th at 2 p.m. On the 14th, people who've been listening to the show may really want to get out and go to the Bluebird Nesting Box Sale at Sandpoint Superdrug in the parking lot at 604 South 5th Avenue. From 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. during the Bluebird Nesting Box Sale.
So appropriate. We know they're here and the swallows, so let's get those nests.
On the 14th, beginning on the 14th, is the American Sign Language course at the Sandpoint Library. It looks like it's going to go over the course of about a week on Saturdays. So learn more about the American Sign Language from certified instructor Susan Schaller. For more information, email Susan. schaller@gmail.com. If you haven't missed it, this is the last weekend Schweitzer's open, and there's going to be a pond skimming contest. That's assuming there's no ice on the pond. If there's ice on the pond, then I think all bets are off.
I should say so. Well, that's about it, folks. Have a great week, and we will be chatting with you next Tuesday.
Take care.